Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of August. We have two really terrific hours for you today. We're going to be starting with author Rebecca Skloot. You probably know this story, but if you don't, you'll want to read her book. Rebecca was a high school student when she heard a biology teacher talk briefly about Henrietta Lacks, and she wanted to know who the woman was. Did she know how important her cells became? Did she have children? In college, she was a biology major, and she kept running across references to HeLa cells. She studied writing in grad school and did a biography on Henrietta Lacks and her cells. The book was a number one New York Times bestseller for 3 years, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It has won all kinds of awards. It took over 10 years to research and write. And Rebecca has won awards for this. She evidently is going to see this made into a movie fairly soon as well. Rebecca specializes in narrative science writing. She's explored so many topics: goldfish surgery, tissue ownership rights, race and medicine, food and politics. This story has another leg to it because the NIH, recently they had meetings with the family members of Henrietta Lacks, because after the cells were taken, nobody in the family was told. Henrietta Lacks never gave permission for research, nor had her family. An agreement was reached early in August with the National Institutes of Health, which does grant the family a rather limited say over some of the research. So we'll be talking about that update with Rebecca. Also joining us this hour is a gentleman who, there are a lot of ethical questions surrounding all of this, and we'll be speaking also this hour with Michael Kalikman, who's director of the San Diego Center for Ethics in Science and Technology and director of the Research Ethics Program at the University of California, San Diego. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and if you would like to leave a message for us on our Facebook page, you can do that. That is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And let's start with Rebecca Skloot. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
I get the impression that everybody has read the book and knows the story, but of course that's not the case. So if you could just summarize what it was that you discovered. It turned out to be an incredible discovery, and it has received so much attention. Aren't you glad that you asked the questions when you were back in high school, huh?
Yes, it's sort of one of those stories that really shows you that following your curiosity in moments when you wonder something can lead you in very unexpected directions.
Absolutely.
So Henrietta Lacks was a poor black tobacco farmer who grew up in Southern Virginia. And in 1951, when she was 30 years old, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. She went to the doctor, and before treating her, her doctor just took a little piece of her tumor and put that in a dish. And he did this without telling her. And at that point, scientists all around the world had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. And no one knows entirely why, but her cells just took off. They never died. They're still alive today, growing in laboratories all around the world. And they were really one of the most important things that happened to medicine in that era. They were very quickly used to help develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what
Goodness.
Would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Hers were the first cells ever cloned, the first genes ever mapped. We have, you know, IVF, in vitro fertilization, in part thanks to her cells, the HPV vaccine, some of our most important cancer medications. The list just goes on and on and on. And she died soon after, not knowing the cells had been taken. She also had five kids who were not told about the cells until many decades later.
And what's somewhat ironic about all of this is that we're talking about a very poor family, and weren't there some members of the family who didn't even have health insurance?
Oh, absolutely. And to this day, you know, some of them struggle to get access to health care. And I think that's one of the things that is so hard to reconcile for people when it comes to this story. Here you have this one woman who, without her knowledge, made such an important contribution to medicine. And her cells, in addition to leading to all this important science, they really helped launch a multi-billion-dollar industry. You know, cells are bought and sold on a regular basis. Now, they're some of our largest biotech companies can be traced back to companies that started off just selling her cells, and her family can't go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So that disparity is a very difficult one for the family and also, I think, for a lot of readers.
We'll talk about the settlement in a moment, but what strikes me about it is that it really doesn't involve any kind of financial gain for the family, even though you just said it's become a multi-billion dollar industry, her sales.
Yeah, one of the things that's hard when you start talking about money within this story is that George Guy, the scientist who grew the cells in the 50s, what he did was not out of line with the standard practices at the time. He took the cells without her knowledge, but that was happening all over the world. Scientists were taking samples really from anyone they could get their hands on. We didn't even have the concept of informed consent at that point. And he couldn't have imagined that someday these would be worth any kind of money. And he gave them all away for free. So he never profited. In fact, he went into quite a bit of debt trying to do the science that let the HeLa cells grow. And it was only down the road that people started to sell them for any sort of profit. But really, that profit was pretty minimal. And the way that HeLa cells led to any sort of money was through allowing other advances. So, you know, if you had taken HeLa cells and put them on a table, they would have died. So some scientists, you know, had to invent things to let them be alive. And then they took those cells and did lots of research with them that then became products that involved many other, you know, ingredients and many other pieces of research. And so piecing out what part of all of that was HeLa and what part of it was, you know, the various other ingredients and the scientists has always sort of twisted people in knots. It's very hard to try to quantify in any way where the money came from or who really would pay the family if anyone was to pay them, since George Guy gave them away for free and they sort of, you know, became this widely disseminated product, you know, a tool. So that's always been a part of it. And for on the scientist side of the, you know, there's this concern that if you pay the Lax family for these cells, it would set a potentially dangerous precedent. Mm-hmm. That what I often hear from scientists is, well, if we pay them, what about the millions of other people whose cells have been used in research and who pays them and how much and how do we figure that out? And we don't even know who those people are. And so it opens up this enormous issue that we really haven't dealt with in this country of how do you handle the commercialization of science and how do you inform people that that might be happening and who shares in it? And, you know, so it's a big issue. And when I talk to people about it, I think in a lot of ways what it comes down to really is access to healthcare. Because what I hear over and over again is, you know, here samples are being used from people often without their consent to develop some sort of products, you know, vaccines, drugs that are then sold back to people who often can't afford them.
Exactly.
And so when I travel and talk about the book in other countries, this question of do they get a check for this really doesn't come up in the same way. What I often hear is, what do you mean they can't go to the doctor? Mm-hmm. You know, how is that possible? And so I think if we had a slightly different system where people were able to benefit from the research that resulted from their tissue samples, that we probably would hear less questions about where the money's going.
The family also had concerns, rightfully, about this information that would, in some ways, say what their genetic blueprint was, and it may indeed, pre-existing conditions, all of that. If that information is out there, it pertains to her children, her grandchildren, her great-grandchildren, and the agreement reached with the NIH will do something about that. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, so I think just to back up a little bit about what this latest development is. So in the story of the HeLa cells, there were several moments where the family was sort of brought into research. So in the 50s, you know, scientists took her cells without consent, and that was one big sort of moment in the story of the cells. And then in the 70s, the way her children found out about the cells was that scientists went back to her kids in order to do research on them to learn more about the cells, and they did that without consent as well.
Really?
So then her children were a second generation used in research without consent. And then in the 80s, some of the family's medical records were released to the press and published without their consent. So the one thing we know about HeLa cells is that every decade or two, something is going to happen with this research that's going to lead scientists back to the family in some way. And that's what just happened. So in March, a group of scientists in Germany sequenced the genome of the HeLa cells. And they published that online. So anyone could have downloaded it, you, me, anyone. Mm-hmm. And what that is basically the genetic instruction book of the HeLa cells. And while the cells themselves were her cancer cells, so there's definitely quite a bit of abnormal genetics going on in there, within that genome is also Henrietta's genome. So you can learn quite a bit about her her personal, you know, medical information, and also things we don't really know what they mean yet. So there are a lot of genes in there that you can say, well, this might mean her family has a tendency towards this or that trait. You know, one of the jokes that the family tells now about this is that one of the traits that she supposedly had was this resistance to baldness. And of course, most of the men in her family are bald.
Right.
You know, and so some of it is that there is this information, we don't know what it means yet, but her children inherited 50% of those genes, and each generation is a bit less and less. But what we know is that their information is in there, and that without their knowledge. And so it was another moment where scientists sort of brought the family into research in some way without consent. And so that happened in March, and I reached out to the family. I heard about this publication of the genome, just like most other people did through the press, who just sort of announced that it had happened. And no one had asked the family's permission, and no one had even mentioned that in any of the press coverage, that no one that this was done without consent. They didn't sort of think to ask. So I contacted the family and said, do you know this happened? You know, and sort of explained to them what the genome was and sort of started that conversation. And their response immediately was, we want it to be taken offline. Mm-hmm. And we want to talk to the scientists. We want to know what personal information is in there. How could this cause problems for us in terms of privacy? But then almost, you know, their sort of second question beyond how can this impact our family was, how can this help society if we let them do this? You know, so the family is very proud of the science. They really want good things to happen with HeLa cells. They just want to be protected and to be heard in the conversation. So then what followed was a conversation with Frances Collins, the director of the NIH, and Kathy Hudson, who has been doing work in this area of genetics and public policy for a very long time, and she's at NIH now, and a bioethicist who I knew that the family had gotten to know a bit and trust. So I sort of pulled all these people together in a room and said, okay, let's talk about this. And so really that was the first moment when scientists, in this case, Frances Collins and Kathy Hudson, sat down and said, okay, we want to essentially put the brakes on and go back and get informed consent from the family for the first time. And so they started with, here's what a gene is, here's what a genome is. And they walked them through everything that could be in that genetic information. They got to see genetic counselors and talk about it. And then the agreement they came to had to do with releasing the genome to scientists in a way that the family felt also protected their privacy.
I see. We're going to welcome phone calls. And we also want to add to our conversation for a while Michael Kolickman. He's director of the San Diego Center for Ethics in Science and Technology, director of the Research Ethics Program at the University of California, San Diego. And I believe, Rebecca, I know you've been speaking all over the world, but he brought together a group of interested scientists and concerned people after your book was published. And I think they were expecting about 100 people, and they had to move the venue because hundreds and hundreds of people came to this event as a result of the book. Just think of your book. Nobody would know any of this if it weren't for you, right?
It's funny, true. As a writer, I have a very hard time saying that.
But I can say that for you.
You
it's
can
amazing.
It has been unbelievable to watch. I mean, you know, I know so many writers who spent a decade or more working on books that they believed were needed to be part of a big public conversation. And, you know, that was really my goal. I wanted to lay out all the different sides of the story and essentially say, discuss. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of issues related to the family, and so much of it applies to science today and, you know, everyone today. And to have that discussion actually happen and happen on such an enormous scale and in the arenas it did. Like, did I ever imagine that I would be, you know, listening in on a conversation where the director of the NIH was personally explaining and getting consent from the Lacks family for the first time? No, I could have never dreamed that that would happen, mm-hmm. even though the moment it started happening, I thought this is exactly what this all would have been leading to. And, you know, I spent so many of the years I was working on the book was also with Deborah Lacks, who was Henrietta's daughter. And what she wanted more than anything in the world was for that moment to happen, mm-hmm. for her, for the younger generation, now the third generation of Laxes to be dealing with the HeLa cells, to sit down in a room with the highest level scientists and have them talking to each other in a way that was respectful and caring and hearing each other out and working together to help science. And that you know, I mean, I felt Deborah in that room every moment of those discussions because it was exactly what she wanted.
Extraordinary story. Rebecca has said that she is excited and encouraged by how open the public and the scientific community have been to discussing the issues raised by her book and using those discussions to work toward a future that involves more transparency about research practices. We're going to be talking with Michael, and Rebecca will stay with us for this hour, about what were the issues that were raised by the book and how the scientific community and the community at large deals with some of these ethical issues. He'll be with us momentarily. We'll also be welcoming your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Rebecca, of course, author of a book that was number one on the bestseller list for 3 years. No small feat. The book is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rebecca Sloot is with us, and we're also going to ask him to join the conversation for a while, is Michael Kalikman. He's director of the San Diego Center for Ethics in Science and Technology and director of Research Ethics Program at UC San Diego. I know, Michael, first of all, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, I'm delighted to be part of this conversation.
I know that you asked Rebecca to come and speak, and it turned out you had to move the venue because so many people wanted to hear what she had to say. What would you say were the ethical questions, the discussions that needed to take place and that were raised by her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks?
Well, there are, unfortunately, the easier question is what weren't the ethical questions? There are so many surrounding this. And if you think of ethics as trying to figure out how we should act or how we should not act, the answer to that usually doesn't come from somebody just saying, here's a principle, and now we all know what we need to do. It comes from specific stories. And Rebecca, you were complimenting her a moment ago. She has done, I believe, a tremendous service to the scientific community by taking this one story, which first taught us and had us look very closely at one particular issue, which was informed consent, and then how we handle medicine and questions of access to health care. And the story has only grown with this recent question, which was inevitable, and that's the genetic questions for the family. So if you ask what was the primary question that came up when she first joined us in San Diego, the primary question then was this question of informed consent. And as Rebecca said, at the time of Henrietta Lacks going in for treatment for what turned out to be cervical cancer, the concept of informed consent wasn't memorialized in any sort of process or system at that time. However, I think we should be fair in saying that it wasn't a totally foreign idea to human beings. We already had created something called the Nuremberg Code after World War II, which called for people who are going to be involved in research to be involved knowing what they are, having a choice, knowing what they are in for, and being able to make the choice of whether they're going to be involved in that research or not. But scientists are human beings. And human beings can look at something and say, that's a great principle, but not see how it applies to what they do. And the scientists, the medical doctors at the time of Henrietta Lacks, this was just not on their radar screen. It wasn't because she was black. It wasn't because she was poor. It was because scientists thought, we're doing good things. If we can learn something from this patient, that's good for society. So there's no need to ask the patient if he or she gives consent.
Mm-hmm. You probably heard her say, which I found very interesting, that when she speaks to European communities, their questions frequently are about access to health care in this country. That's part of the story, that family members didn't have insurance, and here is their mother or grandmother who is given this extraordinary gift that she didn't even know about to science that has made some people wealthy and certainly has helped so many lives all around the world, and they can't get health care. That's an ethical question too, isn't it?
It's a huge ethical question, and if we step one step further back, you realize that this is not just a question for Rebecca, for Henrietta Lacks and her family. It's a question for how we do science. Everybody who has participated in research studies and has contributed to medical research has helped us take steps forward in our understanding that often results in profit and costs mm-hmm. for a medical industrial complex.
Right.
But those people also may very well, many of those people may very well have no health insurance, limited access to health care. It isn't just this one family. This one family helps highlight a much larger issue. And as Rebecca said, we haven't solved this yet. In this country, we have created a system to develop new drugs and new treatments that could be life-saving, but we have not developed a system that ensures that that will be accessible to the people who contributed to that, the people who live in this country.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, when you say that you want the discussions that have come to light as a result of your book to begin working toward a future that involves more transparency about research practices and better communication and trust between scientists and non-scientists, let's talk about the latter part of that. What kind of communication and trust do we need?
I think that's it's a huge part of this. And I just want to, before I kind of go there, I want to say, hi, Michael. Thank you for that. And also, I just want to add, in terms of what Michael was just saying about, you know, other participants in research not getting access and, you know, that they're helping the science move forward, so are tax dollars. I mean, that's one of the things that comes up in this a lot is here we have a system that individuals are, you know, donating, giving tissues, whether they know it or not, or they're participating as subjects in research trials that are funded by everyone's tax dollars, not just those people. And then all of that is then turned back into something that's sold back to people who don't often get research. So the ways in which the public is investing in this science moving forward is incredibly broad. It's really everyone. And then just in terms of the communication side of things, you know, and I know, Michael, this came up when I was there talking as well. Everywhere I go and speak, this question of communication comes up, because when you look at the book, in some way, it's about so many different things. It's about race and medicine, access to health care. It's about, you know, science. And one of the things it's about is communication, because if you look at the story, there were key moments, particularly in the 70s, when scientists went back to her children to do research on them, that if they had been able to communicate to her family, if there had been a conversation in that moment, everything would have been different. You know, so the scientists came to her children, and the way they understood this phone call was essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive, or part of her is alive in the laboratory. We're doing research on her. You know, Henrietta's husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And the scientists didn't realize that. They also didn't realize that the family thought they were being tested to see if they had the cancer that killed Henrietta. So they didn't know they were being used in research. They thought they were receiving some kind of medical care. And no one on the scientist side stopped to just say, okay, before we go forward, do you have any questions? Or tell me quickly what you think is going on here. Right. And they would have said, oh, well, you've got part of Henrietta alive. You're doing research on her. We're not totally clear about whether that causes her pain somehow. They were very worried, particularly her daughter, Deborah, about the impact this research might have on Henrietta sort of in the afterlife. And we think you're testing us to see if we have cancer. If that moment had happened, you know, hopefully, the scientists would have said, oh, no, that's not what we're doing, and then tried to explain it to them. But it never happened. And so decades then of research on the family and things followed that didn't need to happen. If there was had just been some communication, if someone had explained to the family what was going on, they would have, you know, they've always said, we're proud of the science. We would have said yes if someone had asked, but they didn't. And then all these other things kept happening. And that gets at so much of issues with public trust in science. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the need to build public trust, both in terms of getting people to participate in research studies, which we need to have happen so the science can move forward, and also in terms of getting people to trust their doctors so they go get treatment when they need it.
Right.
You know, there are so many stories about things happening without people's knowledge historically, you know, that the public, you know, when they find out that tissues are being used without their consent or anything else is happening that they don't know about, it damages that trust. And there have actually been several studies now that have looked at people's attitudes about tissue research that have said, you know, are you in favor of it? And across the board, for the most part, people understand this is important research. They want it to happen. they just want to know about it. And the numbers, I can't remember the exact numbers right now, but it's, you know, up in the high 80 percentiles of people say that if asked, they would give consent happily to, you know, have their tissues used in research. But then when you rephrase the question and say, would you be okay with this if not asked, it drops down to something like 20%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people support the science. They just want to know what's going on, and they don't want to find out after the fact, particularly when money's involved.
Right.
You know, so when they find out someone may be making money off of this, even if it's not much money or even if the money never happens, it still damages that trust. And so for me, this moment with the Lax family and the NIH is a really hopeful one, because I think it sends a really a big message to scientists and the public that says, we are talking to each other. You know, we are in this room hearing each other out, and positive things can come of that. You know, some scientists worry that if you bring people into the discussion who aren't scientists, they're going to inhibit research by making unreasonable demands or saying no when they're asked. And, you know, I think for the most part, that's, you know, There's no way in which communicating science to the public could possibly damage science.
Right,
it's really
right.
The other way around.
Michael, did you think that the agreement with the NIH went far enough, or was it pretty slight?
I think it, for the question being asked, I think it was a wonderful, personally, I think it was a wonderful compromise.
Mm.
But the agreement, in its sense, is opening a door to a much bigger conversation.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I'm going to challenge you and your listeners to think beyond just this very specific case where we have a cancer cell line that came from one woman where they're learning about its genomics. So if you ask, what does this tell us about her descendants? It tells us some things, and there may be some piece of information there, but it's very distant from their own cell lines. And many people may think, this isn't going to happen to me. But we are getting better and better at being able to get genomic information, not just from that one cell line, but from everybody's cells. We are on the verge of being able to have every doctor plan to look at the entire genome for every one of their patients. What are we going to do with all of that information? As Rebecca mentioned earlier, it's not certain information. Some things we don't even know what it means in there. Some things we know it means only a small probability of a problem, and some things mean a probability of a serious problem. How are we going to decide what is going to get told to a patient because you can't tell them all of those things, and because most people, quite frankly, do not have the awareness and understanding of genetics and how it works and probability to even deal with that information? It's there. It's coming soon. And the public needs to be involved in the conversation about how we're going to best deal with that.
Yeah. And before we go to phone calls, they are coming in, of course. Rebecca, I wanted to ask you, the other part of this story, which is just amazing, is that here is Henrietta Lacks, who has become the world's ultimate donor and has done this woman's cells, and who she was has lived on and will live on in all this important research and breakthroughs. And for her family members to know that story that you told has to make them so darn proud, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing to watch the Lax family's reaction to all of this. And, you know, the younger generation, the third generation, the one who is actively involved in this process now with the NIH, they're the ones, you know, the NIH created a committee of people who will approve use of the HeLa genome in research, and two members of Henrietta's family are on that committee. So, and those are two of her grandkids.
Aww.
So that generation is actively involved in this in a way that no generation of Lax's has been. But they're also the generation that grew up, in some senses, for the first time, hearing information about the cells, learning about them along the way. You know, there was always this journalist hanging around, you know, for the last 14 years of their lives, following them around. And, you know, and they read the book. So before the book came out, I sent about a dozen copies to the family, and they distributed them among different members of the family in different generations. And the younger generation's reaction when they read it was, their first reaction was, Henrietta is a rock star.
Right.
This is awesome. They were so incredibly proud of the science and of her. And at the same time, they were able to step back and say, we understand why our parents' generation is mad. Like,
mm-hmm.
we didn't know what had happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
They never talked about it. And So they come at this as a generation that is seeing very much the positive in the science and also understanding that it should and could have happened in a way that wouldn't have caused trauma. And, and Henrietta's kids are there as well. I mean, her son, Sonny Lax, the sort of middle son, does a lot of public speaking. And he, I think, schools sort of students and faculty members that maybe expect him to get up and be angry on stage. And he just gets up and beams and talks about the endless emails they get from people saying, I am alive today because I took this drug that your mother's cells helped develop. And thank you. And I'm sorry this was hard for you. They hear responses like that by the hundreds of thousands, mm-hmm. I think, at this point. And I think that's been very therapeutic for them on some level.
Yeah, I'm sure it has been. Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is with us, and Michael Kalikman, director of the San Diego Center for Ethics in Science and Technology, director of Research Ethics Program at UC San Diego. You probably heard this story. The National Institute of Health announcing last week it had reached an agreement with the family of Henrietta Lacks. She was the unknowing donor a long time ago of an immortal. These cells are just incredible. They're HeLa cells, and they have spurred medical research for over six decades. So we're talking about the ethics involved in this, the agreement that was reached, and getting yet another chance to talk about this book, which has been a New York Times bestseller for 3 years. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can use all those ways of getting a hold of us. Martha in Racine, our first caller. Hello, Martha.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello?
Yes.
It's really a privilege to talk to Ms. Food. I was wondering, I teach nursing, and I was wondering if she knew of the best way to teach the students about Henrietta Lacks. And basically, the students are young students who are privileged, certainly when compared to the Lacks.
Yeah, I think, reading the book, talking about the book with students is certainly something that's being done widely in medical schools, nursing programs, even, undergraduate, high school level. On my website, I've put together a lot of sort of answers to frequently asked questions. There are a lot of teaching guides and materials there. That's just RebeccaSkloot.com. And so I think that's part of it. And you mentioned the privilege, and I think that's a really important part of it. One thing that I hear a lot when I speak about the book is, I think, there is a big story here in terms of privilege and access to whether it's education or healthcare. I think one of the things I hear often is it's very hard for people, particularly in the sciences, to imagine how it's possible for a family to not have known what a cell was. And I think people don't understand what the education gaps can really be when they're talking to the public about science. And so I think that's an important area to sort of dig into and really try to explore with students. And so there are materials related to that on my site as well.
Mm-hmm. Is your biology teacher still alive?
He is. And there's a scene in the prologue of the book is essentially me as a 16-year-old in his classroom. And he mentioned the cells and wrote her name on the board and then said, she was a black woman. And that was it. And I went up to him after class and I said, who was she? And what else do we know about her? And did her kids know anything about these cells? And what did they think? And he just said, sorry, nobody knows anything. See if you can find something, write up a little paper. I'll give you some extra credit. And that was 1988. And I actually tracked him down when the book was done, and I sent him a copy of the manuscript, a little note. Dear Mr. Deffler, here's my extra credit paper. It's decades late, but I had a good excuse. It was hard to find anything.
Aww.
And his response, I think, was really beautiful, and it says a lot about this story and just sort of curiosity in general. He said, this is why we teach. You never know what single sentence you say in a classroom is going to land on someone and change what they do with their lives, and then, they maybe potentially change other people's lives as a result. And he had no memory of me in that classroom whatsoever. I was just one of hundreds of students in a huge auditorium. But, I was out there listening, and, he had no idea.
Mm. I'm interested in your response to that question, Michael, too. How do we teach this?
Yeah, I think the way we teach it is we want students, scientists, members of the public in general, to just be prepared to talk to one another. It's not easy. These concepts are not easy, but because they're not easy doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And that's basically the issue. In San Diego, we tried, in a sense, teaching this by creating spaces for public conversations, for reading groups, for high school students to come in to present their views of these topics and writing their own papers, the way Rebecca wrote her paper eventually, but smaller papers, their own papers about this story. There are just a thousand ways. You teach by engaging people, and that's the lesson for this and for everything else.
And I think the communication, I mean, that's one of the things that's been so incredible about doing all of these events. I think the most productive of the public events surrounding this book have been the ones where, you know, scientists will stand up and say, you know, this is what I learned from this book and this is what I, you know, feel. And then members of the public will stand up and say very different things. And I think scientists and the public being in a room together, you know, and hearing from each other and particularly having a diverse audience. I mean, I think it's very important for, you know, African-Americans, you know, to stand up and sort of respond to the book when there are, you know, scientists, white scientists in the room,
sure.
So they can hear how they're responding. So I think having as much diversity of discussion is really important.
Thanks, Martha, for your call. Let's go to Bert in Verona. Hi, Bert.
Yes, hi. I would like them both to comment on the case of the UCLA physician who was telling his patient that he needed to come in for tests as part of his treatment, but in fact it was just to extract samples for his research. And this every time he came in, this was a painful procedure for the patient, and he was never told that it was had nothing to do with his health. And in the end, the physician made millions of dollars off of this. The patient found out about it. It went to court, and the patient lost in court. The court said, gave him nothing. Could they comment on that?
When was that case,
yeah,
Bert?
This was the John Moore case, which started in the 80s, I believe. Michael, you may,
yeah,
I think
the 80s. I don't remember the date, but 80s sounds right. But.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And yeah, he was diagnosed with a very rare form of cancer, and he went in to the doctor, and his spleen was removed as part of the treatment, and a cell line was developed from his spleen that ended up being very unusual and very valuable. It was patented, and the patent was licensed for millions of dollars. And yeah, so he found out eventually because his doctor kept calling him in for these strange follow-ups, like, I need hair and semen samples from you, and he kept saying, but what does that have to do with my spleen? And so eventually he found out, and it did lead to a lawsuit, and right, it went on for over a decade, and it was, you know, at first the patient won, and the court said, you own your body, and you have rights to the tissues that come from them, and then it was appealed, and then they ruled in favor of the scientists, and back and forth, and back and forth, and in the end, the final decision was, once a piece of your body is removed from you, you no longer own it. And that was a long time ago, and quite a few things, you know, other cases have happened since then, but that has sort of set the precedent in terms of the legal tone that people use for talking about ownership. And Michael, I'm sure you have things to add to that.
Yeah, well, especially since it was in California, I guess I have I have an obligation to say something. First, not all things that scientists do are in the best interest of the way science is done. This was not a good way to operate. There wasn't a legal structure at the time that meant that the scientists were obligated to have done something differently. And so a court case created a structure for us to move forward, which is, you know, on the surface of it, it seems kind of a weak solution. And the solution is that anytime you do human subjects research in California, you have to include what's called the Moore Clause, which basically says that you, as the research subject, should not expect to gain, you know, even though there might be a commercial venture that will come out of this, you should not expect to gain from this. Now, that, given our entire conversation, may seem that we're going in the wrong direction, but it is complicated because we also are not telling the patient that they have to take any financial loss that will occur if this doesn't pan out. So the question isn't just, did these cells come from you? The question is, what is the work that has to be done to make this possible, and how will we use it later? Who will benefit? Will it just be the wealthiest in our society?
Right.
Or will we have a system, as we discussed before, of broader health care that means that we all benefit from the contributions that we as society members collectively have contributed?
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. We're continuing with the news story of last week, the life of she is immortal, Henrietta Lacks. National Institute of Health announcing it had reached an agreement with the family. She, as you know, and we highly recommend that you read the book too. Many of you have, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. So the family members, a couple of them, will have a seat at the table when it comes to future use of cells, all as a result of so much has happened as a result of Rebecca's book, but that's part of what happened. And we're looking at all of the ethical questions that are being discussed now as a result of this book and as a result of this case. Rebecca is with us, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and Michael Kalikman, director of the San Diego Center for Ethics in Science and Technology. 800-486-8655, the number, the email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let us go to an email question that has come in. Leslie from Preston, Minnesota. What is it, Rebecca, that makes Henrietta's cells so different than others? And is it the cancer cells that are doing so well or her other cells?
Yeah, they are her cancer cells. And what's interesting is that if you had asked me that question any time earlier than last week, the answer was, we don't know. And there were a few things we did know, one of which is that she had HPV, which caused her cervical cancer, which is the sexually transmitted virus. And she also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system. And scientists had thought maybe that had something to do with her cells growing so intensely, that something about the HPV and syphilis together. But a lot of people had HPV and syphilis, particularly in the 50s, and their cells didn't just take off. So there was something unusual. And with this publication of the HeLa genome that just happened this last week, connected to this NIH announcement, we now have a much better answer to that question, which is that they in looking at her genome, they isolated the exact location that the HPV virus landed in her genome, and it just happened to land in a certain spot that activated the most aggressive cancer-related gene, really, that we have. And so one thing we know from cancer research is that when this particular gene is activated, it can create incredibly volatile cancers. And that's what happened with her. So some of it was just absolute chance in terms of where this virus landed, that it created an incredibly aggressive cancer that also they are thinking is part of why her cells grew as intensely as they did outside her body, too. Mm.
Kurt is our next caller, Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good afternoon. Thank you. This is going to, if you care to answer this question, it requires some conjecture on your part, kind of a sociological question. If Henrietta had been a very wealthy white woman, would this procedure, would the scientists have pursued what they did? And if they did, would her descendants have been more interested in gaining personal gain, royalties or whatever, from the results of that research?
All right, interesting question. Michael, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think that both Rebecca and I have noted that that would have had no impact, as far as I think any of us know, on how her cells would have been handled in the 1950s. The cells would have been taken regardless of her status. It's a different question, though, to ask, and this I'm not going to speculate on, about whether a wealthy family would have asked the same question. Would Rebecca have written her book about Henrietta Lacks if it had been a wealthy family? I don't know. Maybe she can answer that part. So
yeah,
the book helps prompt this.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a question that I get pretty often. And I think there are some ways in which, you know, it would have been different if she'd been white. And one of them is that the ward where she was treated at Hopkins was called the public ward. And this is where you went if you were black or if you were poor. So I think had she been white and poor, she would have ended up in the same room that she did end up in, which is this public ward. And more research was done on individuals in public wards than not, because there was a thinking at the time of, well, you're receiving care for free. You sort of owe it to us in a sense. This is part of the payment, as we get to do research on you. So that did happen in those particular clinics. But they were also taking samples from really anyone, including their own family members. So you know, she would have ended up in this, in a similar place if she'd been white and poor. But, you know, chances are if she'd been white and rich, she would have also had her cells taken. Where I think that question played the biggest role in the story was with her family in the 70s. So I think in the 1970s, when scientists went back to her children to do research on them, I think it would have been a very different story if they had been white, period. And if they, particularly if they had been white and well off and had had access to a different sort of educational system, they would have been, I think, probably better prepared in some ways to confront some of the questions that they had in terms of asking them of the scientists. But more importantly, I think in that moment, the scientist who went and did research on her children was one who was raised in the era of segregation. Uh-huh. He did not, he was, he, you know, he never had a, any sort of reason or training that would make him feel like he needed to explain something like this to a black family. Whereas I think he actually probably would have responded differently had they been white. And I, so I think in that moment, they might have received very different information. And I say this having interviewed him quite a bit and about his own sort of background and hearing, you know, there was a moment when I was interviewing him when he said, you know, I hope you can convince those people that this is nothing bad happened here. And the way he said
those people,
I just went,
right.
Makes you cringe. Such a gap between him and them. And this was part of the communication problem, I think. So I do think that there's something there, but that it most people look at it in terms of whether they would have taken her cells if she'd been white, and I don't think that's the question.
Yeah. I read today that Oprah's doing a movie on this book. Is that right?
Yes. It's going to be an HBO film, and she's one of the producers on it.
And will you have say-so? Are you involved, too?
Yeah, I'm a consultant on the film, and so are several members of the Lax family.
Oh.
So we're going to be involved in the screenplay and all of that, though I'm not writing it.
Mm-hmm. Just one more thing that's come from this book. Yeah. Comment from a caller who couldn't stay on the line. Our idea of informed consent has changed since Henrietta. Now the consent for breast screening and blood tests include consent that the tissue or blood can be used for further testing. Michael?
Yeah, so this is a hot area in medical research now. We know that we could learn so much if we could do things that we haven't anticipated yet with tissue that we keep in storage. So people would like to have a more open-ended consent, as you just described, that says we might do this and we might do things later. The fair thing to do, though, is to tell people this is what we're going to do and always re-consent them. As another question for society, do we want to err on the side of protecting the individual's right to make every choice, thus limiting the research that will be done? Or do we open up the research to whatever might be done, but by doing that, we individuals have consented to things they may never know and might not have approved if they did know?
Hmm. Yeah, and one of the things I think that's important in terms of this discussion is that, you know, we the laws and the regulations that govern tissue research today were written essentially the first draft of them was in the 70s before we had any sense of what was going to be possible with this. So our laws have not kept up with the research, and right now much of whether you have to get consent at all if you want to use tissues from people depends on whether they're anonymous. So if samples are taken for some routine practice or, you know, a blood test or a biopsy, and they are quote unquote anonymized, meaning your identity is stripped from them, those can be saved and used in research without getting consent. But we also know that scientifically it's possible now to identify someone from a quote-unquote anonymous cell because of the DNA in there. So we know that's technically possible now, that really anonymity doesn't exist necessarily with cells. But our laws and our regulations hinge on that idea of anonymity. So there have been all sorts of proposals to say we have to change it. So all research on tissues has to require consent. And as Michael was saying, you know, the questions of what that consent will mean, you know, do you give people the option, I only want it used for this particular study and then nothing else in the future unless you ask, or you can use it for whatever you want, I don't care. But that discussion sort of needs to happen. And regulations were proposed to change over a year ago, and they were sent out for public comment, and then they sort of disappeared. So it's in process, but no one knows exactly where it is.
Mm. Well, fascinating story. Thanks for writing the book, Rebecca.
Thanks for talking about it.
Yeah, our pleasure. Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I love the part of the story where she just had the question of her biology teacher and in high school a few years ago wondering about Henrietta Lacks, and look what happened as a result of that. She joined us from studios in WBEZ in Chicago. We thank them, and we thank Michael Kolickman, who's director of the San Diego Center for Ethics in Science and Technology and director of Research Ethics Program at UC San Diego. The book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, was very popular among book clubs, I know. It spent 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. And if you haven't read it, there are many layers, as you can tell from this conversation, to that story, and it's well worth a read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Please stay with us. We're going to have a lot of fun next hour. Irish Fest starts tonight on the Summerfest grounds here in Milwaukee, and we'll have some live music with us from a terrific group, and we'll also talk about the Scots Irish. So that's coming up.